Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 130A, a special episode where we celebrate our 10th anniversary. 10 years ago today, on October 13th, 2015, four rising scholars, Dimitris, Pedro, Miranda, and Ralph, launched the Talking About Organizations podcast with an episode on Frederick Taylor's The Principles of Scientific Management. In this special, current day cast members reflect on what we have done and what we would like to continue doing in the program. To learn more about this program and its mission, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Sam. I'm calling from Lisbon in Portugal.
Hi, this is Sarah calling from London.
Hi, this is Pedro calling from Berlin.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. And welcome to the 10th anniversary of the Talking About Organizations podcast. So this is a special day, but we're doing it a little differently than we have done in the past when we've hit various milestones. Unlike in the past where we sort of stopped the ordinary release, we are doing this in conjunction with a traditional episode. We're going to release this with the episode on Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Although we couldn't have planned it this way, it's almost a very appropriate book to discuss in conjunction with what's going on in the world right now. So what we wanted to do was have a separate conversation about, say, the podcast, working backwards from where we are now and also kind of looking forward to where we may take the podcast in the future, because so much has happened in the past couple of years that it's really worth discussing. The first question that we might want to address, because this podcast was formed 10 years ago as a way of discussing and putting energy back into our understanding of the classics, but our understanding of what is a classic has definitely changed over the course of time. And so I ask that as like a first question is, what do we consider to be a classic now? And is there such a thing as like a modern classic as we've attributed to some of the newer readings that we've done?
So one of the things that I always think of in a classic, and I got this from a couple of the editors at ASQ, was to think, will this paper be taught as part of doctoral syllabi in 20 years' time? You know, a few generations of doctoral students down the family tree. And we could think of different ways of why a paper can be taught. So it could be that it changed the field, as you alluded to with the discussion of Kuhn next week and what changes and the size of changes and how long they take to be adopted. So it could change the field. It could add a new method. So it could be an exemplar methods paper when you're writing up. Just like with citations, and you can have negative citations and rebuttal citations, you could have a classic paper of a what not to do paper. I mean, you would hope it doesn't get through peer review and get accepted, but journal processes have changed over time. More recently, as the 60s, papers were accepted on the editor's say-so and their expertise and their network and what they thought was important. So you could have some papers that are chronologically old that have had a long history in the field, but perhaps don't deserve it. And you want to revisit that. So I think anything that you would bring up as a teachable moment to me fits the definition of classic, and that's independent from its publishing age.
I agree with you, Sarah, that that's kind of the more accepted, widely shared definition of a classic. And I think I share that to some extent. But I think what I really liked about this podcast for the years that I've been a part of so far is that I do see a kind of effort or openness to push or to challenge the definition of what a classic can be. And I think we see that when we've engaged, for example, with maybe work that speaks to organizational issues, but from a different discipline, which I think was one of the first things that I realized. The classics that you get taught in organization theory courses in a business school are different from the classics that you get taught in organization theory courses in a policy school, for example, which was my personal experience. So I like that the podcast kind of has a space for these interdisciplinary classics to come together and speak to each other. And I think the other one that has been really nice for me to see in a couple of episodes, I'm talking here about the Ibarra Colado one and the Anshuman Prasad one, is also being critical of, again, to refer to Ibarra Colado's epistemic colonialism and the idea that some of the texts that we've always thought for sure are classics come from a very limited part of the world. So also challenging and opening this idea of classics, you know, there might be some overlooked classics that we can now revisit and that also speak to very important issues in the field.
I think continuing what Sam was reflecting, part of me, of course, thinks that the syllabus is a good test, but the question is also whose syllabus, which syllabus, right? Because this can get very clubby in terms of who defines that is the canon. And I must admit, I have used this as a heuristic myself as well. But I think that the problem is that it's also a very individualizing idea, right? That it's a paper that is going to be taught. But I like to say that ideas have parents and paper have kids or any kind of intellectual kinship and connections and networks. So any paper, that the reason why it is, even in that definition, a classic, changing the field, adding a new method, being what not to do and so on, is in relationship with a conversation. I remember when I was doing my PhD that I had a colleague who was doing a PhD in physics, and he talked about how in physics, apparently there are journals called letters. And I thought it was such a good view to what a journal publication can be, because they are, you know, if you go back in history also, these are basically records, and scientific communities would use them to circulate their findings and knowledge and so on, right? So it always exists in a conversation. And I think that's what somehow has always been some of the reason why we had this as a goal in the podcast, was partially to decenter our view as scholars, as interested readers, from ourselves, from current debates, and trying to look back and see more expansively, right? To always try to see what is the inspiration, what is behind that, who was speaking about this already before. And so in a way, it's almost like a trick to decenter the conversation instead of the latest paper or a particular known figure currently, and trying to think broadly, more ecologically, what is this network of ideas, right? So where do they come from? How they have evolved? And of course, because we have, as Sara was saying in the beginning, this heuristic implicit about some canons and exemplars and whatever, we could use that, right, to say, yes, well, we're going to talk about that, but through a classic, which basically means talking about the work of someone else that existed before you or before the current conversation, right, in order to bring this more, let's say, broader conversation to bear on a topic.
In defense of my syllabus suggestion, though, I didn't say which syllabus. And I think what constitutes a proper doctoral education is changing. I think it's true that the intro to theory or the sort of core theory and methods classes in many places have ossified depending on who teaches them, who was their supervisor, and how long they've been teaching the same class. It's true. But if you, listener, have any ability to influence what your department teaches, either in that core syllabus as part of the syllabus project or anything else, that's one place that you can bring it in and insert these kinds of discussions like the podcast. Top tip, you can actually use the podcast on your syllabus. You can pair mixed materials. But also there are new groups that I think we have now. We have things like reading club or journal club, writing club, R&R sessions. Some departments I know have rejection parties. Every time someone gets a major rejection, you have a little, you know, drinks due, and then everyone talks about their rejections to normalize the wibbly wobbly path of a paper. So just because we'd like it to be something that is taught, I see these episodes in a way as teaching. It just means you have a mentor to guide you. Maybe someone for whom this is not the first time they've read it, or not the first time they've used it, or maybe the use of this paper has changed over their career. I just see it as a way into the material.
I like that point, Sarah, and I'll piggyback on that and Pedro's, that ultimately the conversation is almost redefined, not so much whether or not something is a classic, but why it's a classic. You know, what is it a classic about? And we've talked about this in previous episodes, how much the myths and the misperceptions about some of these classics have arisen and taken over what a classic stands for. And we, in the process of revisiting those materials, have kind of rediscovered, going back to the primary source, you know, what is it that the author was really trying to get at? And also, what parts of this of the paper are ignored that actually have a lot of relevance? It isn't just the Maslow reading. It's actually quite a number of our recent episodes have uncovered things that the discussions in the field have overlooked that actually changed the way we understand the classic. And the conversation is another thing, because it's so hard. I found that it's getting harder and harder for people to take time to have the conversations like we're having, where we just simply digest a work and everything that goes into that work for a period of time. You all have been to far more conferences than I've been, but it seems like so much of them have, the ones that I've been to, the time pressure is so great for getting everybody's presentations done and all that sort of thing. There's an assumption that there's social gatherings or whatever to be able to have open dialogue on things, but I've never actually seen that to be the case. I don't know if your experience is different.
I'll go something short. I had a friend that recently was asking around how to find time to read, right, among scholars. And I think she was surprised that everyone said, oh, if you get the answer, please let me know, because I don't know myself. So that's what I have to say on that.
Yeah, no, I agree with Tom. Like, even, you know, the last few months have been kind of a period of many like changes and having to adopt and find new routines and balances in like my family work life. But the podcast is something, this podcast is something I would never consider like not doing, because it's the one thing that ensures that I, you know, like all these books that I have that I want to sometime, so, you know, someday make time to read, they eventually become part of the of our reading list. And, you know, having that commitment to sit down and read the book, and not just read the book, but think about it, like think about what you want to say. What does it teach you? How does it challenge your idea of what a classic is? And then being able to, for 2 hours, listen to you guys and our other colleagues give their own take on the book, and having these reflections that are hopefully coherent emerge. I think it's definitely a privilege. And I think it speaks more to the ideal academic work that I imagined myself doing many years ago than what you actually end up spending most of your time on every week. So yeah, I think it's really valuable. And I think I would encourage listeners to try and do similar things, or just have like a book club or whatever that kind of carves, you know, the space to engage meaningfully with texts.
I want to expand on this, because it also goes back to what Sarah was saying, right? That there is indeed a proliferation. You know, there is, of course, more produced, less time, all this. And at the same time, there is all of these new formats that people have created to come together. Many times on Zoom as well, like we are doing now. But I think the difference is that, from what I see, it's not necessarily, as some is saying, about a typical book club, right? I see some reading clubs that are people presenting their own latest paper and in a particular community, and people talking about that in that community, right? Which is very different from, I think, that our... And I think that's important to what is the broader conversation, right? The one that goes beyond my own work and my own interests, and what is a conversation in the level of the field, for example. And I think that in thinking about that and thinking about classics, it came to my mind the idea of what is the canon for jazz, for example, because one very interesting thing about jazz is that there is a canon. People are able to play some standards, and the standards are shared. And of course, but they always play in a different way. And knowing that vocabulary is what allows people to instantly coordinate and do a jam and all of this, right? Because they have been practicing that. And of course, when they do that, they bring their own take on it. And of course, people can also compose new jazz. But there's an element of being able to join the musical conversation in a jam because you know the vocabulary, right? So I think that's what's important, to have spaces like this, because it gives this kind of sharedness. Whereas if you always promote your own piece of music and just want to get that played, we lose this ability of the commons of intellectual conversations, let's call them.
So that's an interesting norm that I guess we have as a cast that is an implicit one. I don't think we've ever done an episode on something written by anyone on the team. Is that right? Are we self-censoring when we plan our episodes? Are we self-censoring? Oh no, my work's not a classic. We must do Kuhn and Stinchcomb and Schumpeter and Fourcade, you know. Is it just that we have so many others to get through that we'll just wait for ours to age in like putting down a bottle of port, for Sam, right? Like putting down a bottle of port for it to age before it's its time.
Yeah, I know that we had some of our earlier episodes did involve guests who wrote the articles. And some of those episodes were a bit challenging because they sort of devolved into interviews. And we have to be careful about that. We have since had other episodes, even a recent one, that where we had the author, and it was wonderful. Most of what I write is for a very, very specific target audience, which happens to be my own students. So I'm at a professional school and I'm writing stuff for particular professionals where I'm consuming a lot of information. There's an extra step I have to give them to say, hey, I have thick skin. I know some of the things that I write are not going to be agreed upon by everybody in this room. And so try to encourage them to have a frank conversation. I don't think I would have that problem with you all. You would tell me if the stuff I write is bad. You know, that doesn't mean that anything that I would write, I would consider it a classic anyway.
I just was going to say quickly, I think it's by design, right? We always wanted to try to push away from this kind of self-centered tendency among academics, right? So it's not just, I think it's by design. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Yeah, I agree with Pedro. I think so many of, or most of our like shared spaces to discuss work are about discussing our own work or like very recent publications. And I remember Pedro selling me this idea of maybe joining the podcast team, of being like, you know, we need to look back and acknowledge and discuss and revisit these classics. I mean, I've kept thinking about how we started this conversation and the wonderful examples, Sarah, that you gave about like how we're kind of constantly redefining with what a classic is. And I think that's why, I mean, I sometimes I feel I have like a love-hate relationship with this idea of the classic. But I think that's the love part, is that it's sort of a mechanism for us to consider like what's kind of the basic knowledge or the work that inspires us to keep doing what we're doing or what we hope to someday kind of contribute to, right? I mean, of course, I think most of us hope to one day that our work will be considered a classic. And so I think that's why it's useful to keep using this notion of classics, and not as a way of engaging uncritically or just kind of adoring the, you know, this work that we don't question, but on the contrary, to constantly challenge the idea of what are these foundational texts that we think deserve to be discussed.
Perhaps we can then sort of turn the discussion towards what do we consider to be a modern classic? Because we have attached that label to some of the more recent contemporary ones. And I know part of the answer we've given already is that we're expecting that this would be something that would last for about 20 years. But of course, that's speculation, I suppose. What do we think is sort of like differentiates a modern classic from just another really good recent article?
I would say it opens up a new conversation, right?
Okay, I could buy that.
I would say you shouldn't practice without it. So if you're a researcher or a teacher, primary, if you have responsibility for program development, a classic is one where you shouldn't continue your practice without it. And I think the other thing that tells me it's a classic is, imagine if you get your reviews back for a paper and reviewer one says, oh, well, if you're going to contribute to this area, you need to really grasp X paper or engage and show how you're pushing Y cluster forward. You could dismiss that and say, oh, that's just one person's review. But then you go to reviewer three, let's say, and reviewer three says the same thing. Now you're starting to get signals. So I guess I'm talking about signaling theory. No surprise, I study signals and signaling theory. But I guess I'm talking about signaling theory. You start to get some signals that for a person like you in a role like what you have, this text is important.
So Sam was talking about, I think, the features of the modern classic. And Sarah was thinking about its resonance or implication. I think that when I think about some work that can use that label, I think that they have the ability to be more expansive, right? To live to what I was saying before. Somehow I see why thinking about classics matters, because it tries to see the conversation as broader. Imagine it as people that come before us and the conversation that exists beyond ourselves. And I think a modern classic tries to do, especially in a time of so much specialization, right? And so much segmentation and fragmentation, tries to say something that can resonate more broadly, right? That tries to see, it's a bit of a romantic idea, almost like Renaissance way of thinking, that tries to be more holistic, to think beyond, that can exactly say something beyond the particular interest of a particular community. I think the trick one can always ask is, yeah, as you say, that you contribute to conversation X, but how do you contribute to organizational theory? So I think a modern classic has to have some kind of not direct, big, immense contribution to org theory or org studies or whatever is the field that is referenced, but not just a segmentation, right? There is something that is learned there that pulls back into the broader conversation.
Now, what about some of the other episodes that we've done, which to the outside observer may appear to be haphazard, but they've always kind of had a purpose behind them. And that's the things like our choices of movies to cover, our choices of documentaries, some special episodes where we've tackled texts that are not necessarily within the organization studies canon, per se, or at least are in a limited extent. I'm talking about like the Goffman episodes. So what about those? There has been a rhyme to a reason, but I'm not sure we've ever actually come to a consensus on what that rhyme or reason is. It is like, hey, sounds cool. Let's try that.
I mean, I can speak to texts like Goffman's, and that's like, that's the classic of the classics, right? So that's, for me, that's why it's justified. It's like, it, you know, even if they're not specifically about organization theory, but they, you know, they're the foundational text of so many of the pure organization theory classics that for me, that's kind of a given. But I'm interested to hear your reflections on the movies and the documentaries that I've never participated in those episodes. So I'm really curious. I never received like the kind of story of why those episodes like emerged. And yeah, I'm curious.
I think it originally was before to try to do something fun. And when we started, I think the first one we did was 12 Angry Men, and was because we were releasing weekly and we needed so much content. So we said, okay, maybe we need to have something that is not just like a huge book to read and discuss. So I think it was a little bit like this. In time, however, I think it became as an opportunity to also illustrate theory and illustrate the relevance and application of some of those ideas. And I think that's something that doesn't necessarily happen so much in our spaces, because we are preoccupied in building new theory or new things, or, you know, maybe in the case of, for you, Tom, is like practical things. For us, you know, things that have a resonance or whatever, but it still is the new, right? But trying to think, okay, how can we get what we have established and make this more alive through images, videos, documentaries, and so on? Where do we see that? Which, again, I think it's the, for those that are learning about this field, it's one of the first things that you do is to say, okay, this vocabulary, these ideas, they help me see and live and think about things around me in a different way, right? In my workplace, in watching a movie, and so on. So I think it's also an opportunity for us to embody and model what it means to do organizational analysis somehow, right? On a particular story, be it fictional or not.
And I'll add that each choice, I think, has had its own story associated with it. Invictus, when we did the Invictus episode, that was because in our foundation's course, in our program, where we had basically it was about ideas and issues in education more broadly. So we weren't talking about organization studies. we were talking about, you know, how to think critically and use a different medium. And I connected the dots and figured that in, when we're talking about certain organization topics like leadership, like culture, transformation, what a cool movie to try. And it turned out to that it worked really well. American Factory documentary that we did was kind of in the same vein, except that that was a documentary. And here we're talking about classics of organization studies that included a lot of studies of industry. And we were sort of like mapping, let's take some of those ideas and project them to a present day story. What's different about it? Or what do we illuminate, or what got amplified? Some of it was, you know, perhaps opportunistic, but every single one was a little bit different based on what was interesting to us from sort of like the practical angle, I suppose.
Surely it also functions like the walkthrough example in any of your own papers, which is the sort of a context, a crucible context that demonstrates the forces at play, the key actors, their motivations, and it gives you something to bring the discussion back to, especially if other parts of it are disagreeing, where there's dissensus building, you can bring it back to an example. So my favorite non-paper episode we've done is A League of Their Own, not just because I love the film and I've seen it many times, as you will understand if you listen to the episode, but because the other ones that have chosen are sometimes even used in the classroom as an example. 12 Angry Men is used many times. And the different versions of the story, Glengarry Glen Ross. I don't know if anybody's used A League of Their Own as a teaching case or example before. So I sign up to do those ones because I'm excited to hear about how those two parts of my experience, the two parts of my life, those worlds can combine. What I enjoy in my time off and what I enjoy in my work. And so I always look to the non-paper, non-book episodes. And as Sam says, the preparation for those as a moment of reflection or a chance to discover or rediscover.
We've also done historical cases, you know, those readings that basically are case studies of historical events that sort of allow us to illuminate or re-examine things, events through an organization lens. Are there other media that maybe we haven't thought about or haven't explored that would be worth taking a look at?
Well, one that we haven't done is a very meta study, which would be other podcasts. So podcast has exploded as a medium for expression, by a one-way expression by one author, one speaker, but also as this interlocutor and exchange, as a channel in its own right, but as a medium that supports other types of publications. So at some point on our next series plan or sometime in the future, I could envision another podcast or a family of podcasts being source material for us to engage with. And I would love to hear from anyone who has brought podcasts into their syllabi successfully. I have tried it and found it appeals to a certain type of learner, but doesn't necessarily improve learning outcomes. So I am a bit on the fence about making it a core part of my teaching, despite my experiences here and happy memories here. But I would be interested to do a podcast on podcasts.
I like that. And I think it's also interesting. It could also lend itself to a discussion about the use of video and the proliferation of video as a popular medium. Not a formal video, you know, like just like, say, a slate of YouTube videos or a YouTube channel might be worth exploring, because there is tension now between podcasting and video as to which gains more traction or whatever. Podcasting, of course, allows for a lot much more reflective, open conversations, whereas videos tend to be much more heavily produced because they're difficult and expensive.
I mean, Sarah's ideas made me think, because, you know, we have such a preference, bias, inclination, focus on academic knowledge, but there are many forms of knowledge, right? And we talk about organizational theory as it exists in academic conversation, but people make reference to organizational concepts everywhere, right? And maybe Tommy can speak something from the more practice perspective, right? So people use these concepts in the news. They use these concepts in investigations, in reports. People talk about safety culture or coordination or hierarchy or bureaucracy, you know, in all sorts of ways. I've been more and more curious about what we could call, quote unquote, lay knowledge or lay uses of or lay theories of organizing. You know, what it means if you read not Max Weber, right? Or not even an interesting, cute book like we had, The Peter Principle, which is still about authority and so on, right? That is a little bit comedic even. But I don't know, popular conversations, Reddit threads or popular debate, not just as a source in terms, okay, we take a movie and we analyze, but what are the analyses that exist out there that are being done? Again, it goes in the meta, I think, track that Sarah was thinking, right? So analyzing the analysis somehow. So that is something that occurred to me in the moment, thinking about that.
You also asked us about, Sam, about why the less serious or less formal materials, you know, made it in the discussion. And it made me think about something that also has been considered less serious, but of course, with the sociology hat on, it is a very serious reflection of society, and that's comedy and stand-up comedy. So if you want to take a popular culture piece, you could talk about the success of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel as a series. And I would love to do an episode on Mrs. Maisel.
Me too.
Yeah. But also as a serious mode of academic inquiry. So I have a few colleagues who've been pushing this. So Professor Jamie Glore has been studying humor in the workplace for a very long time. She and her lab are now experts on that. And a colleague at UBC, Pat Riley, has done a couple of papers on the norms in stand-up comedy and about joke stealing. He's got an ASR on joke stealing and another one on clowning as a career in creative industries. And then even though she doesn't write on the topic, but is very vocal and publishes in LinkedIn and in blog format on her experience, Daria Morozova has done 65 stand-up shows. So almost in parallel to building her academic career, she has built a following as a, you know, now semi-pro, I guess, stand-up performer. And she's, you know, trying to get to 100 shows. And we talked once before about bringing this to the Academy broadly, and then the Academy with capital letters, like Academy of Management. Pedro already brought up the example of jazz, and we know that there is some amazing organizational scholarship on jazz. And I think that in time, when you ask what will become a modern classic, even though these three strands are working orthogonally to each other, I could imagine the 20th anniversary episode of TIOP talking about these modern classics of the phenomenon of humor in org studies.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, we've used a lot of science, and science is sort of like the metaphor of what we're judging as to be important or useful as, or, you know, us attaching them as classics. This is striking a chord with me because I'm our recent conversations in my organization is about, what about the art of organizing, or the art of leadership, or the art of everything. Comedy is, you know, one of the things that makes comedy so successful, and this includes satire like the Peter Principle, is how it exposes things up to ridicule or to humor that might not otherwise be discussed in a serious fashion, or might not get as much attention if discussed in a serious fashion. So, you know, maybe that can signal some sort of a direction or a theme going forward from here.
This is hard because it gets to the root of what is the knowledge that's going to exist for us to talk about, right? We are kind of knowledge critics, right? We are trying to make sense, and not critique in the sense of, you know, oh, like, don't like, but in the sense of what it is, what it means, how it relates to what exists before, what is the main ideas, how it's part of our conversation, what is the broader, you know, implications, what we can distill from that. Of course, there's as I said, this quote-unquote canon, classic, whatever they are, texts are, of course, one form of knowledge. And there is multimodality, there are videos, right? There are other podcasts themselves, and there are prevalence of non-academic knowledge about organizing, right? And that can be from practice, that can be from people implicit in the way they exactly do humor or do with comedy or whatever, or create art like in jazz. So, and of course, one just needs to think about TikTok and all of that, right? I think that the test is that the most traditional institutions, from the New York Times to a museum to a library, are all on social media and making videos and making podcasts and so on. They don't just create text nowadays. So I think also makes one wonder, where is the knowledge going to go, right? What is going to exist that for to be relevant, to be debated and talked about in the future?
That, by the way, is one of the reasons why we were inspired to put together the Resource Center in the website and do some other things with the program. You know, on the one hand, we know that most of our conversations, you know, we're talking about classics, but there's also the aspect of, for new rising organization scholars, those who are entering the field, the proliferation of knowledge and all of these different conversations that are ongoing. I know when I started my doctoral journey, I had no idea where to begin. And the syllabi and the course structures that were put in my program only did so much for me. And there's so much out there to be explored, to learn. So that's why we included a resource center, which at least allows for somebody entering the program to get somewhat of a bigger picture of what's out there, both in terms of theories and in terms of contemporary conversations. We certainly will continue to let this grow. We do a special page release once a month that is accompanied or somewhat related to an episode we release. So we encourage everyone to check that out or offer it to new students coming into the field as a resource for them to start understanding what they're getting themselves into. We also asked some other cast members if they would like to include a message for this special. Here's what they had to say.
This is Catherine calling in from Northamptonshire in the heart of rural England.
Hi, this is Rohan from London.
This is Miranda calling from Leamington Spa in the UK.
What excites you most about being a part of the podcast? What excites me most about being involved in the podcast is the opportunity to be part of a community of practice where academics and professionals can engage in a meaningful and thought-provoking dialogue together. These opportunities are really rare, if not non-existent, in working life. And as practitioners, we're often fully committed to the doing, and there's little time to be reflexive. But being involved in the podcast essentially forces me to do this more, and I hope, as a result, it makes me better at what I do. Also, I love the diversity of the content and my co-hosts. We're an eclectic bunch of people from all around the world with a myriad different experiences of life and work, but we're all bound together by this passion for the subject and a desire to discuss, reflect, analyze, and importantly, to share knowledge and insight with each other and our community of listeners.
One of my favorite things about being on the podcast is, and it's quite a selfish thing, but it's learning. I'm sure a lot of others have said this as well. It's that ability to read stuff that I might not have read as part of my natural kind of research program or my day-to-day, but I'm learning a lot more about whether it's the classics or contemporary stuff just by virtue of hosting. They say, you know, the best way to learn is to teach. I guess in today's world, another way to learn is to podcast.
What excites me the most about the podcast is the continuous possibility of going back to foundational pieces of work in the field and being able to situate them in relation to today's business world. I think that this is the core value of the podcast, as it shows how our founding figures and thinkers are truly timeless.
Since our last anniversary episode, is there a particular highlight to share? My favorite podcast is always the last one I listen to, rather than the last one I recorded. So the recent Carton episode is right up there with one of my favorites. However, 5 years ago, we were grappling with the impact of the COVID-19 epidemic, and it was around that time that we recorded the Isabel Menzies episode, episode 88, Social Defences Against Anxiety, and that was one of my favourites to record. It focused on her classic 1960 paper, a case studying the functioning of social systems as a defence against anxiety. and the episode highlighted how organizations, particularly in high-stress environments like hospitals, develop social defense mechanisms to protect their members from the emotional toll of their work. It was a concept I was not aware of before reading the case study, but as soon as I did, my mind just lit up with so many examples from working life where this is applicable, where organizational structures, rules, and procedures can serve an unconscious purpose of reducing anxiety. It looked beyond organizations that are just rational systems, but addressed the unintended consequences of human beings which respond to these systems. Menzies' work draws on psychoanalytic theory to show how primitive anxieties, feelings of love, hate, and aggression are projected onto the workplace. And this can manifest in seemingly irrational behavior and procedures that I think we've all seen evidence of in practice. So this was a great opportunity to discuss that, and it resulted in lots of engagement from practitioners as well in our listening community, which as a practitioner myself was very satisfying.
Since our last anniversary episode, particular highlights, I wasn't here for our last anniversary episode, but if I think about highlights since I've been on the podcast, and I guess continuing with this theme of learning, it's been moments where we've done episodes that almost go away from the core of organization and management studies towards, for example, we have an episode on Thomas Kuhn and the scientific structure of scientific revolutions, which is a kind of intellectual history book. I was on an episode where we read Alfred Sloan recounting the history of General Motors. Those are things that kind of take me a bit away from the norm in delightful ways. And that's been kind of my favorite thing of late, going on slightly parallel tracks, either into history or different intellectual threads.
During the last year, I was on maternity leave, and this actually allowed me to embrace the podcast more as a listener, giving me the opportunity to have a connection with my academic identity while also going through important changes in my personal life.
How do I see the program serving the greater academic community now and in the future? Well, I hope one of talking about organizations' legacies will be bridging the gap between traditional scholarship and practitioners. I hope it continues to serve as a point of reference, but also inspiration for both, and remains accessible and challenging for both communities as well.
I think and I've used it, this podcast myself often, where if I'm writing a paper and I want to look, and I'm looking up a specific person or stream of research, I definitely use this as a resource. I remember looking up the Mike Tushman episode because I was reading into something about boundary spanners and innovation. And just on my walk to and from work, I'm catching up on the topic by also looking up first, is there a talking about organizations episode on this, and then listening to it. So, and I hope other members of the community similarly find it useful, where it's not just, you know, listening to a given the latest episode, but also using the archives as a resource and a reference for when you might be working on some stream that is relevant to some of these classics.
Our program serves the greater academic community by continuing to keep the human element in our conversations and discussions. The possibility of having normal, free-flowing conversations on academic topics in a friendly environment, where we may agree or disagree with each other, but in any case we develop our thinking, is ever more important in today's world where the conversations around Gen AI are increasingly dominating.
And as a final word, I just wanted to say a heartfelt thank you to my brilliant co-hosts and to the podcast for challenging me, inspiring me, and keeping me company on many long road trips.
On a final note, I would just like to add my gratitude in being part of this community to my fellow podcasters and to our listeners for keeping our conversations going. Thank you.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.